Yeah. Okay, so what I'm going to talk about, the question I'm going to ask is, how does a tracer move near a swimmer? So how did a little tracer particle move as a swimmer sets up flows in the fluid? And then leading on from that, how can you work out the diffusion constant of a suspension of swimmers? And it's a dilute suspension of swimmers that I'm going to be thinking about. So before before I start, Mitya Pushkin is the person who's done most of the work on this, just coming to the end of his postdoc at Oxford. And also many thanks to Henry Shum, who did the numerical work, and Jorn Dunkel, who was in on the early stages of this work. So that's what I'll do. First of all, I'll tell you a bit about low Reynolds number swimming, and I assume that most people here know more than I do about low Reynolds number swimming. But there are two nice things about swimming at zero Reynolds number. One is the scallop theorem, which I won't say very much about because we all know about that. But the other one, which I actually think is more fun and which people tend to focus on less, is the fact that swimmers have dipolar flow fields. So this bit here is the introduction, and apologies to the experts who know it all already. And then I'll talk about how microswimmers move tracers around, how they stir the fluid up. First of all, saying, well, you know, let's just ask, do they stir the fluid up? And then how do they do it? And I'll start with a simple model and then show you what's wrong with the simple model and use that as a way to motivate the two different ways of stirring that I'm going to look at. So let's start with a beautiful picture from Ray Goldstein's group in Cambridge. This is Volvox, and that Volvox is busy stirring up the fluid, and you can see the tracer particles in the fluid, probably bits of dust in this case, happily moving around and being stirred up by the flow fields induced by those swimmers. What's going on? Okay, so we're looking at microswimmers. Microswimmers are very small, so we're at zero Reynolds number, and therefore rather than the Navier-Stokes equations, what I have is the Stokes equations. And the Stokes equations are very nice because they're linear, which means that mathematically one can get a lot further with them. I think people will know the notation here, P pressure, V velocity, and mu is the viscosity. And I said one of the main things about these equations is the idea of the scallop theorem, that if you have a small microswimmer, the stroke must be non-reversible in time for the swimmer to move. And the reason is that there's no time dependence in here, so there's nothing in the equations that can decide whether you're going forwards or backwards in time. So the swimming stroke itself has to be different forwards and backwards in time in order to get a swimmer to go anywhere. And we know, therefore, that that's one of the reasons that microswimmers have these long helical tails, say, or long wavy tails. The wave moving along the tail picks out a direction, or the turn of the helix picks out a particular direction. However, there's something else special about the flow field set up by swimmers. And let me just remind you, so I can talk about this, about the basic solution, the solution of the Stokes equations. If I just apply a point force, the Green's function of the Stokes equations, if you like, the Green's function of the Stokes equations looks like this. As a result of a point force, I end up with a velocity field given by that equation there. Okay, and that velocity field is sometimes called the Osine tensor, sometimes called the Stokeslet, and really it's the Green's function of the Stokes equation. A physical version of what's going on there is if I took a tiny colloid and I pulled it through the fluid. If you pull a tiny colloid through a fluid, that's just like applying a localized force to this fluid, and you're going to set up a flow field. And this is a picture of the sort of flow field that is set up. And in particular, you can see, as you would expect, if you're pulling that colloid through the fluid, what's going to happen is that the flow, the velocity, is going to be pulled along and actually moved along like that. Do ask questions when I start being unclear. No, yeah. So that's fine for a colloid, but a microswimmer, you can't have a single force like that. Microswimmers move on their own. They're autonomous. There's no applied force. So you can't have an applied force. So what must happen is that any force must appear in equal and opposite pairs. And we know that if we have forces in equal and opposite pairs, then this is going to be analogous to a dipole in electromagnetism. What's going to happen is that when you add up the velocity field due to a force going in that way and a force going in this way, that leading order term is going to drop out. Note that this velocity goes as 1 over r. The leading order term is going to drop out, and what you end up with instead is a flow field which goes as 1 over r squared. So because swimmers have no net force, the leading order term in the far flow field must be a dipole term. It must go as 1 over r squared. It goes as F times L, the force times the distance between the two forces. That's what you expect for a dipole moment. And then it has this angular dependence, 3 cos squared theta minus 1. Here's a picture of that flow field. So here's the swimmer in the middle. And what happens is that the flow field either looks like this, where the swimmer pulls fluid into its ends and pushes it out from the sides. And that's the flow field around something which is contractile or a puller. That one over there, all I've done is just change the sign of the dipole moment so that the swimmer pushes fluid out from the ends and pulls it in from the sides. And that one's going to be a pusher or an extensile swimmer. And note in particular how different the flow fields are for a colloid and for a swimmer. There's a colloid and everything's definitely moving off in this direction, but this one here is a swimmer, and you can see that there's a symmetry in that flow field down a line through the center of that swimmer. That's a sort of hand-waving version of this multipole expansion. Let's look at it in a bit more detail. So this is the same thing done with semi-rigorous maths. Okay, here's the Stokeslet. That's exactly the formula I've had before, except I've put viscosities and 4 pi is equal to 1. Here's the Stokeslet. This is the flow field due to a colloid. Okay, the dipole looks like this. It's the gradient of the Stokeslet. Okay, this is what comes out when you do a multipole expansion. You end up with a dipolar flow field, which is the gradient of the Stokeslet. So this would be the leading order term in the flow field for swimmers. And then obviously if the dipole term isn't there, you get the next term in the multipole expansion. This is the quadrupole term. This one looks like this. So this one's a second derivative of the Stokeslet. It's along the direction of F, yes. It's along the direction of F, yeah. Now, for the experts, when I wrote that down, I'm cheating a bit. The reason I'm cheating is that I've put an extra symmetry in to get these equations. I've assumed that I have swimmers which have cylindrical symmetry, again, long K, along the direction in which they're going. If you just do a multipole expansion, I think I'll take a couple of slides, the next two slides, just to show you in a little bit more detail how you do the multipole expansion. This dipole term here is actually a second rank symmetric tensor rather than just a number, and this one is very complicated with lots of different components. But if you have this symmetry, everything collapses down into these rather more simple formulae. And there are two things I'm going to use from this later on, which please can you notice while we're here, because I'm going to be batting on about them through most of the seminar. In particular, this one here. If I've got a swimmer, and I can forget about the Stokeslet term, no net forces on the swimmer. If I've got a swimmer, okay, I can write the velocity field as the gradient of something. The gradient of something, some sort of function which is like a velocity. If the swimmer was just a dipole, it would be the gradient of the Stokeslet. Okay, gradient of the Stokeslet. For these more a more complicated swimmer which also had the quadrupole term in, it would be the gradient of something more complicated, but it's still the gradient of something. And that's going to be really important in understanding how these traces move. The other thing to notice is I've just written down what this Q perpendicular is. It's a quadrupole moment. How do you calculate it? Well, the answer is you calculated it just as a weighted integral of the forces across the swimmer, and it turns out to be the forces along Z, which is the direction the swimmer's going, weighted by rho squared, which is the radial distance from the axis. And this Q perp's going to end up being quite an important parameter in what follows. The next two slides are just doing that multipole expansion a little bit more properly, in case anyone cares, all right? If no one doesn't care, you go to sleep for the next two slides. Just to make sure what I'm saying, what I've got is a swimmer here, which counts as a distribution of forces, okay? I want to find the velocity field a long way away from this little swimmer, which is like a little force distribution. How do I do it? Well, I just say, right, for each point force, the velocity is given by the Green's function or the Osine tensor, which I'd written down, times that point force, and then I integrate over all the point forces. What the multipole expansion is just an expansion for small zeta, so that the force distribution is a long way away from the point of observation. So I just take that G and I do a Taylor expansion for small zeta. And if you do a Taylor expansion, this is what you end up with, a rather nasty Taylor expansion. Okay? And basically what you find is that you end up with the far field is equal to the net force times the Osine tensor, or times the Green's function. The next term is going to be the dipole moment, this d here, times what's going to come in here. Well, it's going to be the derivative of the Osine tensor, and then so on for this Taylor expansion. And what I wrote out on the last slide was just this bit here, is just Stokes that times the force. This is the term that isn't there for swimmers. And then the dipole moment, which in general is this tensor, times its velocity field, the dipole velocity field, which is just related to derivatives of the Green's function and so on. And then I specialize to this case of special symmetry, where this tensor just relaxes to the single dipole moment. So, does it work? Does it work in reality? Do swimmers really have a dipole flow field? So these are experiments from the Cambridge group again. This is E. coli swimming along, and this is averaging over lots of E. coli. And you can see the flow field. As long as you're far enough away from the swimmer, it's pushing fluid out from its ends and pulling it in from the sides. Okay, that's exactly what you expect for something which is behaving like a dipole. This one here is Chlamydomonas, and what Chlamydomonas does is that it's a real mess close to the swimmer itself, because close to the swimmer itself, you can see that the fact that it's doing breaststroke sets up all sorts of complicated flow fields. But a long way away, what happens is that it's pulling fluid in from the sides and pulling it in from the ends, pushing it out from the sides. So that's a nice contractile swimmer. And, you know, these things look like dipoles. So we're fine till you get to that one. This is this nice Volvox one, which is happily spinning around like that. Okay, that doesn't work. Okay. Because it looks here like the flow lines certainly don't look dipolar-like. What they're doing is that stuff's being pulled down, the fluid's being pulled down past the swimmer. So you might worry about what's going on there. Well, what's going on there is that these things are actually quite big. And so gravity matters. So what that swimmer is doing is sort of desperately trying to keep up towards the light and trying to swim up to the surface. So there is a net force acting on it. And so it's actually rather nice that you get a colloidal-like flow field with a net point force acting. So the experiments seem to work nicely, that you actually see what you expect to see, with the caveat that you do have to be far enough away from the swimmer that this far field approximation works. Now, it turns out that the fact that you have a dipolar flow field for these swimmers has really quite a lot of consequences. And I just thought I'd spend the next few slides telling you what one of these is. And where I want to get to is that the velocity statistics measured in the fluid at a point is very different for a suspension of colloids and a suspension of swimmers. So I'm going to ask a very simple question. I'm going to ask, let's just look at a point in the middle of a dilute suspension of swimmers, and let's try and draw the velocity probability distribution at that point. Okay, it's going to change because as the swimmer gets past, it's going to set up a flow field at that point, and then depending on where the swimmers are, the flow field at that point is going to be different from one moment to the next. What's the probability distribution of the velocity look like? So how would you work it out? Well, let's have a velocity field which goes as 1 over r to the n. 1 over r would be this colloid. 1 over r squared would be this dipolar swimmer. 1 over r cubed would be a quadrupolar swimmer if the dipole term happened to drop out. There's my point I'm looking at, and here's the swimmer swimming around. And the velocity here is going to depend on the distribution of swimmers. And in three dimensions, where are the swimmers going to be? Well, the distance r away from the point is just going to go as r squared dr, just the normal volume element. So let's then translate that r to v. Okay, r squared dr, if I just use this formula here to translate to v, this is what it comes out as. And you can see you have a distribution for one swimmer, which has a power law, goes as 1 over v to the something, which depends on this n. So now let's put in lots of swimmers. Okay, and then say what's the velocity distribution for lots of swimmers? And the answer should be a Gaussian. And the reason it should be a Gaussian is because the central limit theorem says that as you've got lots of swimmers, what's going to happen is that you cross over to a Gaussian distribution. Unless the variance of the distribution is not finite. So if you look at the variance of the distribution, what you actually find is that the variance for n is 1 is finite. So for colloids, that velocity probability distribution crosses over to a very nice Gaussian as you increase the number of, in that case, colloids. But for the swimmers, the variance is not finite. And so what you'd expect is a distribution which stays as a power law, essentially a distribution which looks like a Levy distribution. So we check that. Let's just check and see how it works. We checked it numerically by just, in our computer, having a point and having a load of swimmers swimming in straight lines past the point. And we said, what's the velocity at that point as a function of the number of swimmers in the box? Essentially, I'm afraid I've got it as number here, but really that should be the concentration of swimmers in the box. And what I've plotted here is the velocity probability distribution. It's on a log scale, which is why it looks slightly strange, okay, as a function of the velocity. So this is the probability distribution for the velocity.
So yeah. You say swimmers swimming in a straight line, you mean you did a simulation where each swimmer is one of these dipolar fields?
Yes.
And they just keep going in a straight line throughout the box and then periodic under conditions
yes.
come back at the other end.
Yes, right. Yes, yes. Just the simplest one we could think of.
Tumble or do anything.
That's right. I mean, at the moment, they're just these ones are colloid, so it's a 1/R thing. But I mean, they're just unreal swimmers. Yes, yeah. And the boundary conditions were a little bit more careful because when they escape, we put them back in at random, so you didn't get nasty correlations. Yeah. Okay, so these are colloids. So these colloids should cross over to a Gaussian distribution when I increase the concentration. For small concentration, you can see the power law tail here for large velocities. Then if you increase the concentration, you cross over to a Gaussian. And I'm sorry, Gaussian, because it's a funny scale. Gaussians look funny, but this dotted line is the Gaussian. And so you can see very quickly you cross over to a Gaussian. If instead you do it for dipolar swimmers, so exactly the same simulation, except we replace the 1/R by a 1/R², then this is the same picture, and you can see that for small concentrations, power law, we increase the concentration, and it really stays as a power law for a long time, and eventually we get to a Gaussian. Now, you might complain that we eventually get to a Gaussian, because certainly from what I've said so far, you should stay as a Levy distribution for all concentrations. The reason you eventually cross over is that in the simulations, we had to cut off our 1/R² power law at short distances so everything didn't blow up. And in a real system, the body size of the swimmer and the near field would cut off what's going on. So this is the realistic story, that you end up with a truncated Levy distribution. So the point of that is that dipolar really does make things different. Dipolar fields makes things behave in a different way. And so colloids and swimmers, you know, you might expect to look for different things in the two cases.
Is there a scaling argument that depending on where you cut off your Levy, where you cut off your 1/R², you need more and more swimmers to go to a Gaussian, right?
Yes.
So is there a relation between them?
I think so, but I'm not sure what it is without going and looking it up. Yeah. Okay, so stirring my mind. Sorry, I mean, I can go and look it up afterwards and tell you, but I can't remember. I mean, yes, okay, I can't remember the same. Okay, so stirring by microswimmers now, which we were meant to do. So, first question. Okay, do these things stir the fluid they're in? And second question, how do they do it? Indeed, why do they do it as well? But that's biology, so we can only speculate about that. So first of all, do they stir the fluid? So these again are Cambridge experiments from Ray Goldstein's group, published a little while ago now. This is the displacement of the swimmers, displacement of tracer particles placed in a bath of swimmers, a dilute bath of Chlamydomonas, as it turns out. Okay, and the different curves are different concentrations of swimmers. So the red curve there means no swimmers. And so these tracers are moving even with no swimmers. And the reason they're moving is just Brownian motion. So this is just the normal Gaussian type Brownian motion curve. Okay, but then I throw in some extra, well, he threw in some extra swimmers. And as a function of the concentration of swimmers, what you end up with is curves which look like this. And in particular, you get large tracer displacements. So certainly the curve gets broader, showing that the swimmers are stirring up that suspension. But also, there's really a quite strange shape here. You get these strange shaped tails appearing in that distribution. And I'm not going to talk about that in any detail here, because it turns out to be quite a complicated story, but I'm very happy to discuss that afterwards with anyone who's interested. Okay, so swimmers do stir the suspension. This is another story which again shows that swimmers are really rather good at stirring things. It is cheating a bit, because that jellyfish is a bit big to be a low Reynolds number swimmer. This is taken from a Nature paper written by the first two authors there, saying, do small swimmers mix the ocean? Which was a lovely idea. and it's probably wrong because they probably mix on far too small length scales to have much effect on oceanic mixing. So all the other authors or people who sort of say, well, it was a lovely idea, but probably it isn't right. But it at least shows that if you bung in tracer particles near one of these swimmers, you get these nice movies. And if anyone hasn't chosen their PhD yet, I'd go for this one, actually, and go and swim around Hawaii and squirt things at jellyfish. So we've got this mixing. So let's do the simplest theoretical physics story of how the mixing happens. All right, let's have a swimmer which swims quite happily from minus infinity to plus infinity. All right, put a tracer particle next to it and ask how the tracer particle moves. So we did, and we were quite surprised at the answer. It does that. It moves in a loop, a closed loop, as long as the trajectory is straight and from minus infinity to plus infinity. So why? Well, after a certain amount of hassling about, we realized it's actually rather easy why that's the case. And it's because of the shape of this flow field. We've got a dipolar flow field, okay. Having a swimmer which swims past is like having the tracer move across like this in the rest frame of the swimmer. So what's that tracer going to do? Well, it's going to be pushed outwards to the swimmer, and then it's going to be pulled inwards to the swimmer, and then it's going to be pushed outwards again. Outwards, inwards, outwards. And that's going to happen in a symmetric way just because of the symmetry of this flow field around this center line here. Okay, so tracer particles move in loops near these swimmers, but then I'm in a mess, right? Then I'm in a mess because I have said you get enhanced diffusion, you get mixing. And if all the tracer particles are going to move around happily in loops and come back to the same place, then nothing's going to get mixed. So I've got to explain why you get this mixing. And that's what I'll try and do now. And the way I'll do it is that I'm going to just write down the simple proof of where those loops come from. And then by looking at the approximations that go into that, we can see what we've got to get right. And then I'm going to put right each of those approximations in turn. So that's the slide I had before about the multipole expansion. And this is where we're going to start, that the velocity field is the gradient of something. It's the gradient of a velocity, a Stokeslet, if you like, if I just had a dipolar swimmer. So, equation of motion for a tracer. It's a tracer, so its position, how its position varies with time, is just equal to the local velocity. And like I've just said, the local velocity is the gradient of some sort of field, U. So let's take this U and write down its Lagrangian derivative. So the Lagrangian derivative has two bits. First of all, as the swimmer moves past, the field is changing just because the swimmer is moving past. That's the usual Eulerian bit. And then you've got this bit here, which says that the tracer itself is moving, and so it moves between streamlines. And I'm assuming my velocity is just in a straight line, and I'll call that direction of the straight line k. If I miss out that second term, okay, and you can do that if the tracer doesn't move very far compared to the swimmer, if the tracer velocity is small compared to the swimmer velocity, I can forget about that second term there, and I can just have the Eulerian derivative. So as long as tracer is a long way away from the swimmer, so it's not moved very far, that's okay. And then I can rewrite this equation here. All I've done is put the V as its magnitude times K. But this thing here, okay, is exactly what we had as being dRt by dt. And I can replace it by dRt by dt. And then you can see that you have an equation that you can integrate very easily. You can integrate an equation to get how far the tracer particle moves. And if I integrate it, I end up with u0 at one end of my trajectory minus mu0 at the other end of the trajectory. And as long as that u0 velocity field decays away quickly enough, that's just going to be zero. I've got a closed loop. So what are the approximations I've put in there? Okay, well, first of all, I've missed out this thing here. I've said that the tracer particle is moving very slowly compared to the swimmer. In other words, the tracer particle is a long way away from the swimmer, so that the swimmer velocity field is decayed away a lot by the time you get there. And that's sort of not going to work. If I put the tracer close to the swimmer, it's going to be dragged along by the swimmer. And that's what I'm going to call entrainment, and that's what I'm going to think about first. Then this swimmer swimming happily in a straight line from minus infinity to plus infinity is a bad thing, right? Swimmers don't do that. I'll show you a picture of some swimmers from Oxford which do that, but in general, they don't do that. So we have to worry about getting the infinite swimmer path right. And then there's the assumption that this velocity field decays quickly enough that I can just forget about it at the ends of the trajectory. That's fine for dipolar swimmers in three dimensions. For dipolar swimmers in two dimensions, it's not fine. And there's some nice experiments from a Golub group which show that mixing is enhanced in two dimensions, and I don't understand why, and I don't understand whether it's related to the behavior of that u0, but I think that's a really nice question, but I'm not going to talk about it today because I don't know the answer. But the other two bits, we sort of know how to get those right, at least within some approximations. So let's start by thinking about entrainment. Okay? And we can't do anything analytic now, so we have to do simulations. So these are the simulations done by Henry Shum. He set up a swimmer which looks like this and had it swimming happily through the fluid, solved the Stokes equations using a boundary element method, taking care that there's no slip conditions on the surface of the swimmer and that the swimmer is torque-free and force-free like it's meant to be. And these are just the numbers that he used. The one we're going to have to worry about is that the volume of the head of this swimmer is going to be 1, our unit of volume. The volume of the head is 1. And then let's take that swimmer and make it move through a plane of tracer particles, material sheet, the mathematicians call it. Okay, so the swimmer's moving through a plane of tracer particles. Where does that plane of tracer particles end up? And at the moment, I'm sticking with an infinite swimmer trajectory. Okay, so this is the story. Here's the swimmer moving here from minus infinity to plus infinity. Here's the plane of tracer particles. These particles here start a long way away from the swimmer, so the closed loop story should work. And it does. I mean, these things go around in closed loops, and they end up more or less where they started. Then as you get closer to the swimmer, what happens is that the tracers move further away from this line, so the finishing position is backwards. They actually get pushed back by the swimmer.
So the simulation is actually three.
Yeah, the simulation, this is all spherically symmetric around the middle of that swimmer, yeah. So, other questions? Sorry, no, just, are there other?
What
yes?
is the long knot in comparison to the swimmer length?
Same order, about 2.
About 2.
Yeah. Swimmer width, yes, yeah. We have actually an exact expression for it. Yeah. Okay, so and you can see that what happens close to is that the displacement moves in a different direction and the particles actually get pulled along with the swimmer. And this actually diverges. The particles get pulled on quite a long way to infinity if they were very close to the swimmer. And it sort of makes sense because if you've got a particle which starts on the nose of the swimmer, it's going to get pushed on forever. So it turns out there's some quite cute bits of maths you can do about this. You can actually work out exactly this displacement at long distances. That sort of makes sense, because you've got a far field expansion for this thing, and so you can work out this length here. I've written down the expression there. We actually know these constants. This one's pi squared over 16, I think, but it doesn't really matter. And it goes as kappa squared. So both pushers and pullers push fluid backwards a long way away from the swimmer. The other thing you can do is you can work out the total amount of fluid moved by the swimmer as it swims along this infinite trajectory. That's called the Darwin drift. Okay. What I mean by this is that I integrate the total amount of fluid in this volume here, and it is a volume because I'm integrating over, it's spherically symmetric around the swimmer direction, this total amount of fluid in this volume here with a sign. Okay, so this contributes negatively and that contributes positively, actually has a value you can work out exactly, and it turns out to be, I'm not sure universal is quite the right word, it turns out to be a nice short formula which doesn't depend on much, is probably the right way of saying it. This is the Darwin drift, this is the volume of the Darwin drift, 4 pi q, q is this quadrupole moment that I showed you a bit ago, v is the velocity of the swimmer, and then this V star is the volume of the swimmer plus its wake if it's got one, which normally they don't have at low Reynolds number, but they can have. Okay, so this is true for any swimmer. It's an exact formula for any swimmer. The total amount of stuff it pulls along with it is just given by that simple formula there. Now, it's called the Darwin drift because this formula was first discovered by Darwin in a completely different context. The context of swimmers at, no, not swimmers, sorry, colloids at infinite Reynolds number. So inviscid flow, very high Reynolds number, and we're thinking about colloids. In that case, you get a formula which is really very similar. If you look at colloids at zero Reynolds number, the amount of fluid pulled along by the swimmer is infinite. But for these swimmers, because you get a 1 over r squared fall off in the velocity field rather than the 1 over r fall off in the velocity field, what happens is that you actually get a finite number. And it's a finite number which is only depends on this very this one property of the swimmer.
It's always positive. It depends on the force in the right?
Q-perp.
But it's always defined in positive.
No, not necessarily. No, no.
So
I think we've got
it. Does it make a difference in this case if there are pullers or pushers or not?
No, because that would determine the sign of kappa,
right.
And kappa is not the thing which comes in here. Yeah. I'll show you some numbers in a minute to see what. Yeah. But I couldn't look at a swimmer and predict this. I mean, you really have to measure it for a given swimmer. Okay, so let's look at some numbers. Now, this Darwin drift, let's actually work out what it is for a given sort of swimmer. So I actually want to measure it. So we start with our sort of base swimmer like this, and the base parameters are a head shape like this, total volume 1, but ratio 2 to 1 there. Lambda is 2, that's this length here. L is 10, that's the length of the tail, so there'd be 5 turns in the tail. 5 turns in the tail. And then we change one thing at once and see how it alters this Darwin drift, i.e. does this swimmer push fluid backwards or pull it forwards, and does it depend on the shape of the swimmer? So the important thing for us was that this row here, which is the numerics, and this row here, which is, that's the numerics and the analytics, the only important thing for us was that they came out the same. But let's actually see what they do come out as. Okay, this is the Darwin drift in units of that volume of the head of the swimmer. And you can see that on the whole, it's negative, right? And it doesn't change much. So it's negative. So what does that mean? Well, it means that basically this volume here is bigger than that volume there. Now, I know it doesn't look it, but we're integrating over an angular coordinate. So most of them push most of the fluid backwards. This one here turns out to have be more efficient at pushing fluid backwards, this swimmer here. What that swimmer here is one where the head is like that, an ablate head. So a head like that means that the swimmer is more efficient at pushing fluid backwards. I haven't really got an explanation for that, that's just what comes out. And we spent a while looking at what makes them pull fluid forwards, and eventually we managed to find a swimmer which had a positive Darwin drift, so that likes to pull fluid along with it. And it turns out to be this one which looks like a sperm, one where the tail is much bigger than the head. And then you can think biology and say why. Well, it may be that sperm cells swim in a viscoelastic fluid, so it might be nice for them, might be easier for them if they're able to pull fluid along with them rather than having to push it back past them, but I don't know. Okay, and so that is really the summary of this entrainment story. What happens when the tracer is close to the swimmer? Long way where you get loops close to, it pulls the tracers along with it. And then you have this rather nice exact result that the total amount of fluid moved by one swimmer, you can actually work out. That's this Darwin drift. That's the single tracer swimmer story. It would be nice to understand about diffusion constants, the diffusion constant for traces in this solution. And you can get an estimate for the diffusion constant just by using a kinetic theory type argument. Okay, so you know that when one swimmer moves through, you know how much fluid it moves with it. And then you've got lots of swimmers moving at random angles, and you have to ask how much fluid all these different swimmers move with them. And you can do that using kinetic theory. And if you do that, what you end up with is a formula down here, that the diffusion constant of the tracers, because they're being entrained by the swimmers, goes as n, number of swimmers per unit volume, that you'd expect in the low concentration limit. Velocity of the swimmers makes sense. They're more efficient in moving things around if they're moving faster. And then radius of the swimmer to the power of 4, a strong dependence on the radius of the swimmer. So this is an approximate formula where the numbers are not going to be right, but probably the dependencies on parameters are going to be okay. Right, so that was the first thing we had to worry about. Then the second thing is going to be this random reorientation story. Because the swimmers obviously don't move happily in straight lines, they're all over the place. They've got run and tumble swimmers, and even if they're not running and tumbling, they're going to be mucked around with by diffusion, by noise, by rotational diffusion. So can we do anything there? And then perhaps the nicest question to ask is, which is more important in destroying the loop story? Which is going to be largest, the contribution to diffusion from the random reorientations or the contribution to diffusion due to the entrainment? So before I start on that, let me show you how we were trying to train these things to move in straight lines. This is my colleague Judy Armitage in biochemistry, who was setting up a race. You know, we had the Olympics in London a year or so ago, right? So we had the Olympics, then the Paralympics, and then the Bacterial Olympics. And as you can see, it only takes a bit of training for these things to move happily in straight lines. But given that most of them don't, perhaps we should try and work out the diffusion constant due to random reorientations, because nasty untrained bacteria tend to move pretty much like that. So what you can do is that you can solve a nice simple model of this exactly. The model was first written down in this paper, and what we have added to that is an exact solution. So the swimmers move in segments, and they move in segments of length lambda. And then there'll be another segment, and we assume that the segments are uncorrelated with each other. That is an assumption, okay, because the swimmer's going to move there and then it's going to start its next segment here. But in this model, we're assuming that those segments are uncorrelated. And then we say, okay, when this swimmer moves along there, the tracer is going to move in a certain length delta, and that delta is going to depend on where it starts relative to the swimmer. And if I want to get the diffusion constant, what do I have to do? Well, I have to find the average of this delta squared here. Okay, this average here is going to be related to the diffusion constant, because that average tells me, on average, how far one of these traces moves. Well, you can, just with a bit of thinking about geometry, you can relate the diffusion constant to the average of delta squared. Let's see if I can do it. The average of delta squared, let's see, it's going to be 1 over the volume, and then I have to take my delta squared, I have to take this length squared, and I have to average it over the volume. And then I have to multiply by the number of segments of length lambda. This is the number of segments per unit volume, the number of runs by the swimmer, if you like, because each run's going to contribute to delta squared, times this is the number per unit volume and times the volume. And then if I want the diffusion constant, by definition, it's this delta squared over 2 dimension times time. And number of segments per unit time, what's that going to be? Well, it's just going to be, if the swimmer moves with velocity v, then v over lambda is the number of segments per unit time, the number of run lengths per unit time, and then I just have to multiply that by the number of swimmers. It's one of those things, if you sit down for 5 minutes, it does work, but it's hard to get there first time. Okay, so we know the diffusion constant. So we could work that out. We could work that out if we knew this delta squared, right? But actually, we do know this delta squared, because that delta squared is really this formula here that we had before. Okay? It's that formula there, because what I did before was integrate how far the tracer moved as the swimmer went past for a swimmer which was moving from minus infinity to plus infinity. But what I want now is the same story, but I want the swimmer to move from A to B. Okay, so what I have to do is just do this integral for a finite path length. Swimmer must move from A to B. And so I need my u0 function evaluated at B minus the u0 function evaluated at A. And that's all right, because I know this u0. If I've got just straight dipolar swimmers, it's just the Stokeslet. If I've got quadrupolar swimmers, it's a bit more complicated, but I know it. And so you can actually work out this expression for how far the tracer moves when the swimmer moves through a path length lambda. Then what you would have to do is take that expression and bung it back in here and do the integral. And you can do the integral, but you can do the integral if you happen to have the clever idea that Mitya had of doing it in elliptical coordinates. And if you do it in elliptical coordinates, you can actually do that integral, and you can work out the diffusion constant exactly for these swimmers. So I will jump to the conclusions. Okay. We worked out an exact solution in 3 dimensions for dipolar swimmers. So I've got that somewhere here. For dipolar swimmers in 3 dimensions, This is the diffusion constant due to random reorientations. I've made the approximation that I'm forgetting about this entrainment bit, okay? I'm assuming, and it seems to work well numerically, but it is an assumption that the diffusion is the random reorientation bit plus the entrainment bit, and this is the random reorientation bit. This kappa is a dimensional less dipole moment, essentially the dipole moment, number of swimmers per unit volume times velocity. You'd expect those factors to be in there. A to the fourth again sort of has to be to get the dimensions right, except there's no lambda. So that's what's unusual, that's what surprised us about this formula. There's no lambda. The diffusion constant is independent of the run length of the swimmers. This is in 3D and it's for dipoles. I don't think there's any deep physical significance there. I think it's just that things happen to cancel out. But it's unusual. It was noted numerically in the original paper where they solved this model numerically, and it's nice that it comes out from the exact solution. For general dimensions, okay, and when I say general dimensions, I'm cheating. The hydrodynamics is three-dimensional. The swimmers are moving in the dimension I'm talking about. Okay, general dimensions, and then general strength of the dipole. So M is 2 is a dipolar swimmer, M is 3 is a quadrupolar swimmer, and so on. You can write the same formula, but we haven't bothered working out the coefficient out the front because it's not really very exciting. Okay, and what you find is that there are two possibilities. If the dimension and the order of the dipole obey this formula, so basically for our standard dipolar swimmer in three dimensions, what you get is that the coefficient, the diffusion constant due to random orientations has this scaling. This scaling with dipole moment, number of swimmers per unit volume, velocity, run length, and swimmer size, right? Dipolar swimmer in 3D, 3 plus 1 is 4, minus 2 times dipolar is M is 2. That's where the lambda dropping out came in. And what you find is that every point along the path contributes to the displacement essentially in the same way. Okay? You find that mathematically this integral is regular at its lower cutoff, which of course is the swimmer's size, and what you end up with is a distribution of tracer run lengths which converges to a Gaussian. If, however, you have the condition like this, which basically would be for a quadrupolar swimmer in three dimensions, you can get quadrupolar swimmers. They're ones which the head and the tail look the same. They have a symmetry, so you can't tell. If you made them swim backwards, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. That would be the symmetry which would give you a quadrupolar swimmer. There, the lower limit of the integral is singular, and what you end up with is a different dependence on these parameters, and what you find is that the distribution of tracer run lengths is one of these truncated Levy distributions. So then you ask the question, which is more important, the random reorientations or the entrainment bit? Which is the one which is dominant in a real swimmer suspension? For these regular swimmers, i.e. pretty much all the ones you're going to do experiments on, 3D, E. coli, that sort of swimmers, what you get is that the ratio of the diffusion coefficients goes as this dipole coefficient squared, the dipole moment squared. This is about 10 for E. coli when you work it out, and so it's the random reorientations which dominate, and if you put in numbers, you get really quite a nice agreement with some recent experiments by Wilson Poon. For these quadrupolar swimmers, though, where no one's done experiments, but it would be interesting to do them, and probably active colloids would also come into this category, then you get an extra factor of A over lambda appearing, swimmer size over run length, so this is small, So for this sort of swimmer, you'd expect a different sort of mixing to dominate. You'd expect the entrainment to dominate.
So yeah. Experimentally, I think it's possible, right, to vary the tumble rate and to have different mutants, maybe, where the tumble rate can be varied.
Yeah.
Do they actually find the independence on the tumble rate and the run length, or has this been looked at?
We're way away from that.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, maybe not way away. I mean, it's about 6 months ago with the experiments which actually measured the diffusion constant. Okay? And so at the moment it doesn't depend on anything, it's just a number. But that would be a fun thing to try and do. But of course in real systems life's a lot more difficult. Yeah. Okay, so that's the conclusion for this part of the talk. And indeed for most of it. So what do we need to do? Oh yes, I was just going to show you. This is a nice movie. This is from Jeffrey Guasto's website. Because the green things are swimmers swimming and the red things are the tracers. So maybe we can actually see these loops and see entrainment. So if I manage to stop this at the right time, which I probably won't, but there. Nice entrainment here. Oh, these are the loopy ones. The nice loops here. Okay, that one's being entrained. It's a bit longer. You can see entrainment there beautifully going along with the swimmers. These are being entrained nicely there. Okay? And sometimes you can see loops. There's some nice loop ones there. But of course it isn't as beautiful as the theory because you have Brownian motion and goodness knows what else going on. And you're looking in a 2D plane and the swimmers are swimming in 3D. But I think you could see basically what's the same sort of idea.
Aren't the experiments in a thin field?
Are they? I didn't think so.
Okay.
I mean, certainly they're looking at the thin film. You might be right. You might be right. But I'd assume they were just so that when these things disappear, they're going out of the frame, but maybe not. Yeah. Okay, so there's all sorts of things we don't understand. Obviously, there are correlations we've missed out in this simple random reorientation model. If you do simulations with a model which puts the correlations in, it doesn't seem to make much difference. Real swimmer suspensions can get very dense, and we're way away from that limit here. What happens when you have swimmers which interact with each other, or a tracer which interacts with more than one swimmer at once? We're working at the moment on what happens if I have surfaces or confined swimmers, and basically you keep the same story, but the details of the entrainment are different between the swimmer and the surface. And then of course there are these nice questions which biologists ask. So thank you for listening, and thank you for the people who did all the hard work.
So, hydrodynamics and log divergences.
Yes.
So, what will happen to diffusion? Will it diverge?
We don't know. We don't understand. There are these amazing experiments done in. Worrying about two-dimensional hydrodynamics versus 3D hydrodynamics. Yeah, first of all, to say that our results, when I say 2D, I mean, yeah, the hydrodynamics is 3D, because I don't know how to do it with 2D hydrodynamics. There's some experiments in a thin film, swimmers in a thin film, and the diffusion constant looks like it's increased by a factor of about 10 over swimmers in three dimensions. Now, maybe the thin film is sufficiently thick, you should think of it as 3D hydrodynamics with surfaces. Maybe not. That's as far as I've got. I don't know any more than that. I think it's a fascinating question how that works. What we have seen is that actually if we have a swimmer near a slip surface, it actually pulls the tracers underneath it forwards a lot further than it does in the bulk. So that may have something to do with it, but you know, only very may.
Sorry. You said we should now pay attention in big significance to the fact that this result isn't dependent on lambda for the dipolar swimmer. So on. The DRR is independent lambda. But I still find it very surprising because usually I think of if you're one of these running tumble, if you're running tumble dynamics, and the tumble rate is very, very high, in some sense, the particle is sort of like just a ground particle.
Yeah.
And so it seems strange that there is no dependent fluid. Do you have anything you can say about it? Do you have any real understanding of it?
Well, only that you can sort of break things up in terms of its number of swimmers times area, volume of length lambda around a swimmer, times number of segments which are causing things, times the amount each segment makes it move. And it's just that balance. So I think there are more segments of length lambda, but each of them moves the swimmer by less. And it just happens to cancel. Yeah, so as far as we can see, it just happens to cancel. What's quite fun is what happens as the system gets smaller, because when the system size approaches lambda, something's got to happen, because that things must break down. And you can see scaling, how you cross over from this infinite system limit to a system where the diffusion is governed by L, the system size, rather. And that has to happen as lambda approaches the system size.
Question. Hi. So is DRR, this diffusion due to orientation, this expression showed us, is that only actually valid at the dilute suspension? As when you go to a dense suspension, I think you showed us this distribution of the displacement, the mean square displacement of the tracer as you increase concentration of bacteria.
The velocity field of the tracer.
I think after that, you should ask the mean square displacement, I guess, or just the distribution of the...
Distribution of velocities. So it is different because if you want the displacement, there are many more correlations than in the velocity field. I mean, at short times, the displacement is velocity times time. Yeah, but then another swimmer comes past, and that changes it. So you can't go straight from velocities to displacements.
But I think you showed us the distribution of displacement where it goes from Gaussian to...
Oh, sorry, the experiments. The experiments,
okay.
Yes.
Right, so that's... So it seems that at a large concentration, then the tracer doesn't move in a Gaussian way. It seems that... So this strange shape, does it indicate that the calculation for the DRR is only valid at a small tagging fraction of the swimmer?
No, we actually see those heavy tails. You can actually see in the numerics that we look at. And it's because the crossover from... Let's see if I can get this right. The crossover from the dilute limit to the Gaussian is quite slow. And it's quite slow because you're sort of on a borderline between where it's going to cross over to Gaussian and where it isn't. This is actually complicated because this is actually a short time plot.
Oh, okay.
So it's sort of picking up velocity times time.
Okay.
So it's sort of picking up the fact that you have this levee-like velocity distribution. But if you looked at the distribution for the DS3 dipolar case, has a Levy distribution for the velocity distribution, but for the displacement distribution, it actually has a Gaussian distribution. So it's this sort of borderline case, and the borderline moves past it, depending on what you're looking at. But I still find it hard to explain this. I can talk about it afterwards if you like, but it's quite tricky.
Yeah. A very naive question. Can you talk about energy in this regime?
Energy. You can talk about the efficiency of swimmers, and people have asked that question quite often.
Is it related to the amount of mass that you have to move, or not?
Gosh. I mean, I'm not sure what the right answer to that is, I mean, there's a lot of dissipation. There's a lot of dissipation in terms of viscosity. So you could ask how much work this thing does to move the mass. Is it related to that? Possibly. I think it could be. Yeah, I think that might be an interesting question to think about. But it's going to depend partly on the mass that's moved, but also on the viscosity of the fluid, because that's going to determine how much energy is dissipated while it's moving the thing. Yeah.
Thanks again.